From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we're watching news today from French officials who say a ship has picked up a signal from beneath the Mediterranean, possibly one of the flight recorders from lost Egypt Air Flight 804.
So we're keeping an eye on that. But also here in the U.S., southeast Texas is bracing for extensive flooding as the Brazos River has risen to record levels outside Houston. At least six people have been killed. Hundreds of buildings and roads have been damaged. Jeff Braun, the emergency manager for Bend County, told Houston Public Media that the situation is extremely serious.
The water is high. That means all the drainage ditches are high. All the creeks are high. If we get any rain at all, it's going to exacerbate the problem.
Well, the National Weather Service has issued a flash flood watch for many parts of the state and is predicting more rain this week. Jose Luis Jimenez is managing news editor at Here and Now contributor Houston Public Media. He's with us with the latest. Hi, Jose.
Hi, Jeremy.
And it was just a few months ago that Houston had historic flooding because of severe thunderstorms. What's the situation there right now?
That's correct. Like you mentioned earlier, the Brazos River in Fort Bend County continues to rise and evacuations are ongoing. Right now, this morning, it was at 55 feet, and that's a record. And keep in mind that flood stage is at 45 feet. And officials keep predicting that it's going to crest, it's going to start dropping, but as more rain keeps falling up north in the watershed, it keeps running down into Fort Bend County and contributes to the flooding down here. We're talking about more than 100 rescues, about 1,000 properties have been affected, either with water inside the structure or people trapped by high water, and at least six schools remain closed, again, because the buildings are either flooded or the roads to the campuses are impassable.
And when you talk about 100 rescues or when we hear about at least six deaths, what's going on? What's leading people into these situations? Are they in their car and they drive into water that's just too high?
That's correct. Four of the deaths are basically that. Fast rising waters, drivers get swept away, and then they're found later on. The fifth death was basically somebody who was found flooded inside a mobile home. And the sixth death was reported this morning. And that was that was pretty tragic. A 16-year-old high school student who was volunteering to clean up storm debris, he died when a tree limb fell on top of him. So it's kind of a mixture of things.
What are officials telling people about what they should do to stay safe in these floods?
Basically, at this point, they're telling them to get out while they can. Their shelters are open. They can have them temporarily until they can find other circumstances. But again, they're voluntary evacuations. So if they want to stay on their own, basically, they're telling them to be prepared to survive inside of your house for about 2 weeks. Because that's basically how long it's going to take for the waters to recede eventually.
Your station, Houston Public Media, has been speaking with residents who've been affected by the flooding. One of them was Claudia Ortiz of Richmond. She said she's been in the area for her whole life. She's 40 years old. She's never seen a situation like this before.
It's risen some, but it's never like even gotten close to this bad. I mean, never, even there's like houses in the back, it never even got close to that. You could see it, I mean, from far away, but never even this close at all.
And Claudia Ortiz saying that she wants to know if officials are actually doing enough to help the water go down more quickly. Is there something that could be done that's not being done in that regard?
You know, Jeremy, they're basically saying these are acts of nature and not much can be done about it at this point. And to be honest with you, it feels like it has not stopped raining since Memorial Day last year, which was the really first big major flooding event. And since then, we'd have several other flooding events. I mean, they have set up a system. There's an extensive system made up of bayous and creeks to deal with the runoff from these storms. But when you literally get feet of rain that have fallen the past 2 months, I mean, sometimes you get a foot of rain in a 24-hour period, officials say there's just not much that can be done about it. But at least one group of residents disagree. They've sued the city of Houston, claiming that they haven't done enough to mitigate the flooding. They accused city officials of basically having a cozy relationship with developers and not forcing them to mitigate more of the flooding. Of course, the city denies the allegations. And in terms of solutions, there's been some chatter, perhaps buying up these properties that are near these bayous and creeks and rivers. But at this point, it's just chatter.
And at this point, I look at the 7-day forecast in Houston and I see rain for 6 out of the 7 days.
Yeah, I might be booking a trip out to California. yes, more rain is in the forecast. Some of it directly over greater Houston, but actually a lot of it is to the north of the city. Again, even though it might not feel directly rain on us, any rain north of us falls in that watershed area, like I mentioned earlier, and it's going to come down the bayous, the creeks, and the rivers, which already have too much water in them. And again, the water just has to go somewhere, and unfortunately it goes over the banks and into people's homes and properties.
That's Jose Luis Jimenez, managing news editor at Houston Public Media. Jose, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now a story from Idaho that's hitting a small town and a family like a storm, throwing them both in the national spotlight for the second time. And a warning, this story involves explicit discussion of rape. The McDaniel family of Dietrich, Idaho, has filed a $10 million lawsuit against the school district after three of their son's teammates on the football team were charged with brutally raping him with a coat hanger in the locker room. The family says the rape was part of a pattern of abuse against their adopted son, one of the few blacks in this largely white, largely Mormon town. Tim McDaniel, the father, is a biology teacher who was in the news in 2013 when he was accused of violating ethics rules for using the word vagina in a class. That complaint was dismissed, but some residents tell local media people turned on the McDaniels then. Alex Riggins is the crime and courts reporter at the Times News in Twin Falls, Idaho. Alex, tell us more about the McDaniel family. They've adopted up to 20 children?
Yes, they're a very large family. When Tim and Shelley McDaniel got married, they both had children from previous marriages, and they moved to Dietrich. It's this tiny town in south central Idaho. You know, I always tell people you can't get there by accident. It's just this tiny little town, no stoplights, one little bar, restaurant, cafe. And when they moved there, they started adopting kids. And many of those kids, like you said, are black, and they're really the only black kids, black people in the town.
Well, the lawsuit alleges that this one child, who we understand had some cognitive issues.
Yes, he's got some mental disabilities. Right. His parents don't like to, you know,
dwell on that.
Get into exactly what it is. But, you know, he testified in April at the preliminary hearing for one of his alleged attackers. And, you know, he did an admirable job on the stand. He's just a little bit slower to recognize things. He's a little bit slow to recognize that, you know, these kids who allegedly attacked him aren't his friends. You know, he still calls them his friends. And, you know, if what they allege is true, then they're certainly not his friends.
Well, they're alleging in their suit that there were many incidents leading up to this one, that they complained about them to teachers, that they weren't listened to, that coaches, school officials. In fact, in one case, their son was forced into a fist fight by a coach to try to toughen him up. But they're also saying that their other black children also received racist taunts at school, and the teachers, nobody followed up. After the suit was launched, just recently, we understand, one of the boy's sisters, who graduated from this high school, went to visit her dad, again, a teacher at the school, without signing in, and there was a lockdown of the school. Some residents are telling the local papers this was in, you know, retaliation. This feels as if it might be escalating a little.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you mentioned in the opening, Tim McDaniel was the target of an ethics complaint a couple years back. And the family kind of feels like they've been the target ever since then of the town, because it brought kind of national media attention to the town, which, you know, this tiny little town, they don't want that.
Yeah.
And especially in that manner. And so they kind of feel like they've been the target of the town since then. When the civil suit broke last week, it was the second to last day of school at Dietrich, which is a K through 12 school. You know, it's such a tiny town, they can't have separate schools. And the daughter who graduated last year went to go visit her dad, because obviously, you know, he's a teacher there. He was having a tough time that day. She went on campus twice that day. The first time she didn't sign in. She went and visited her dad. Everything was fine. The second time she didn't sign in, and a couple teachers told her that she needed to. And she was on the phone with her dad at the time. He told her, you know what, just go home. They live right across the street. She turned around. She walked away. But the teachers still told the principal that there was an unidentified black woman on campus, which prompted a lockdown. There was police from several different agencies. Twin Falls, you know, which is where we are, 45 minutes away. And really, it was just a misunderstanding. But the family feels like it was, you know, certain teachers, certain people being vindictive against them. Just for everything that had been going on.
Well, look, we mentioned it was a largely Mormon town, which might mean some of the conservatism that we were hearing. But also in news accounts, we're hearing from residents who believe that church teachings of love and compassion are not being enacted here. They're very upset about what's happening to the McDaniel family. So you seem to have both sides going on in the town. Meanwhile, do we understand that the family is moving?
Yes, they've been looking for a home now since last week, when the news of the civil suit broke and the lockdown with their daughter. I mean, that very night they were looking for homes in surrounding towns. I mean, they still have kids in school. They don't want to send their kids back to that school. Tim doesn't want to teach there anymore. they're absolutely ready to get out.
And what are you hearing from townspeople?
It's kind of a mixed bag. There's some people who are on the McDaniel side, and then there's others who feel like it should have been handled internally. You know, it should have been kept quiet. It shouldn't have been leaked to the media.
An alleged rape?
Yeah. That's kind of the attitude up there, you know. They're a small town, you know, it's a big family. They don't, you know, keep things in the family type thing. There is kind of that feeling of they wish it would have stayed more quiet.
Yeah. That's Alex Riggins, crime and courts reporter at the Times News in Twin Falls, Idaho. Alex, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
On the campaign trail, Hillary Clinton is promising to deploy $500 million solar panels by the end of her first term in office. Bernie Sanders says climate change is a moral issue. Donald Trump, well, this week, physicist Stephen Hawking called Trump a demagogue, but he went on to say a bigger threat to the U.S. is global warming, which Trump has said he doesn't believe in, although his golf club in Ireland is requesting to bypass a rule and build a big wall to deflect against high seas caused by climate change. So each candidate has had something to say, but none are asking Americans to conserve. And it's maybe because they remember President Jimmy Carter. He took office in 1977 during one of the coldest winters in American history. There was also an energy crisis because the U.S. was running out of its own oil to pump, and it couldn't import because oil-producing Arab nations launched an embargo after the U.S. backed Israel in the Yom Kippur War. In his first speech, Carter wore a cardigan in front of a fireplace and asked Americans to conserve.
But if we all cooperate and make modest sacrifices, if we learn to live thriftily and remember the importance of helping our neighbors, then we can find ways to adjust and to make our society more efficient and our own lives more enjoyable and productive.
Carter installed solar panels on the White House. He created the Department of Energy. In turn, he received a big, fat raspberry from Americans. Meg Jacobs teaches history and public affairs at Princeton. She writes about all this in her new book, Panic at the Pump, The Energy Crisis and the Transformation of American Politics in the 1970s. Meg, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Boy, we have got to flesh out what it was like in the 70s, because it occurs to us this would be like talking to someone in the 70s about something that happened in the 30s and 40s. You know, it is so ancient history to many people. How bad did it get? I mean, people were killed on lines trying to pump gas.
It got bad, and there was a sense of chaos. There was a sense that America, as the country had known it, was coming to an end. And this led to a frantic rush to the pumps to tank up wherever possible. And people were carrying around a month's supply of gasoline in their tanks rather than tanks in the ground, which, of course, made the shortage worse. And as you say, this led to heightened tensions on the gas lines. There were fistfights. There were even in a couple cases, murders. One man stabbed another to death in front of his pregnant wife.
Yeah. And 10 days later, you write in The Atlantic, another man was stabbed to death because, as a police officer said, well, there was a shorter line and they both were trying to get in it. And there you go. You also had thousands of truckers tying up bridges and highways, 12-mile backup for 7 hours in one case, shutdown of the Ohio Turnpike because they were protesting the lack of gas. In another case, there was a bumper sticker, Carter, Kiss My Gas. There were popular songs that were written.
Yes, there were songs written that captured the sense of this real tension. The Southern oil producers claimed that they could solve the energy crisis if those northern liberals got out of their way and got rid of all of the regulations on the industry. And a popular song coming out of Texas was called Freeze a Yankee.
Freeze a Yankee, drive 75 and freeze them alive. Freeze a Yankee, let your thermostat rise and give them a surprise. Governor Briscoe.
Okay, well, there you have it. Meanwhile, Jimmy Carter keeps asking people, you know, turn down your thermostats. He was asking people to conserve. Was it him, you know, the man himself who couldn't deliver the message? Was it you know, the idea that people were outraged that government was trying to deliver the message. What was happening?
I think it was the message itself. The message itself, it's not something common that we hear presidents appealing to Americans to cut back, to live in a more thrifty fashion, to conserve. And Jimmy Carter was quite courageous in tackling the problem head on. He appeared in a cardigan sweater a couple weeks into office and said, frankly, to the American people that their lives were going to have to change, that they were going to have to dial down their thermostats, they were going to have to carpool, they were going to have to use mass transit, and they were going to have to fundamentally rethink the way that they had lived a life of abundance throughout much of the post-war years. And then he made this appeal once again in the summer of 1979 when there were mile-long gas lines. He went on national television and appealed to Americans again to cut back. And this was at a time when Americans were literally rioting at the gas pumps in Levittown, Pennsylvania. There was a gas riot where local citizens set two cars on fire and paraded around with signs that said more gas, more gas. So the intentions and the desires of Americans were quite clear.
Let's listen to a little bit of that speech, July 15th, 1979.
Take no unnecessary trips. To use carpools or public transportation whenever you can. To park your car one extra day per week. To obey the speed limit. And to set your thermostats to save fuel.
And when he says obey the speed limit, it was set to 55 to try to get people to slow down. Look, he obviously failed miserably, lost his reelection bid to Ronald Reagan. There was also the Iran hostage crisis. What happened then?
Well, when Ronald Reagan runs in 1980, he's able to use the energy crisis and the gas lines and the shortages as exhibit A for why government has failed and why government as a whole is not the solution to our national problems. And he is able to capitalize on the sense of frustration that Washington can no longer provide. And he wins in a landslide, and out goes conservation, and in comes a president who is much more of a champion of full-on production. It's an early version of drill, baby, drill. And when we are not able to supply enough of our own fuel, Reagan calls for a greater military presence in the Persian Gulf, and that will culminate ultimately in the Gulf War in 1991.
Well, you can actually track some of these changes. Smaller Japanese cars, which people had started to go towards, you write they were all the rage in the 70s, were replaced by bigger gas guzzlers. There was a new hit song. Let's listen to a little of Sammy Hagar's I Can't Drive 55. Ronald Reagan also takes down the White House solar panels, and the Republican-led government starts to work more on deregulation.
Yes. One of the things that Ronald Reagan promises in the Republican Party platform is to repeal the 55-mile-per-hour speed limit, which seemed to embody, which really seemed the most egregious sign of this age of limits that Carter had espoused. Americans hated the speed limit, and Reagan works hard to get it repealed. And it's something that resonates with the public who does not want, they do not want to be told to slow down, to cut back. And Reagan says the way to a more abundant future is to get rid of all kinds of regulations on the energy industry, from environmental regulations to price controls. And the very first thing he does when he comes into office is, through executive order, repeal all of the price controls and allocation measures that were in place throughout the 1970s.
Well, so now here we are in 2016. We have another presidential race. You say we are at another crossroads, and a lot of people would agree with you that when it comes to climate change in particular, something has to be done. But we also have a Congress that research shows a huge number of them are climate deniers. We have people who think that, well, look, we've got natural gas and fracking. We also have facts like this was astonishing. In 2015, more people got jobs in solar and wind than in the oil industry, and employment in renewables was three times greater than in coal. But we just saw how this played out on the campaign trail. Hillary Clinton lost because of coal workers who, you know, Donald Trump is promising them that he'll bring their jobs back.
It's a difficult issue. It's a very divisive issue. And I think one of the lasting legacies of the energy crisis and the failure to solve it in the 70s was the way in which it undercut confidence in government to solve any of our problems. So if Watergate and Vietnam taught us that our presidents lie or we can't trust them, then the energy crisis taught Americans that government didn't work. And that was one of the lasting legacies, which I believe today makes it difficult for us to make arguments that government can play an effective role as we transition to a new energy economy.
You know, I'm thinking of one thing, though, California, which might be an example. You know, it asked the state, it asked people to conserve. And one of the first concerns was, well, do you mean everyone? You know, are the wealthier towns going to be able to get away with not participating? And they made it clear that it was going to be across the board. It feels like you have to tap into that anxiety too, right? That there will be a class distinction of some sort and make sure that there isn't.
Yes, for sure. And we see this on a global scale, too, right, with the Paris Agreement. So how much will the United States as a whole have to sacrifice, given its outsized contribution to emissions? How much will the United States, relative to other countries, have to be asked to cut back?
Yeah.
So you see this both locally, state by state, and then even internationally.
Well, meanwhile, Meg Jacobs, in 2016, people are talking about unease at some of the anger they're seeing at rallies and on the left and the right. Boy, we're reminded by your book, they ain't seen nothing, you know, compared to what happened in the 70s. The book is Panic at the Pump, The Energy Crisis and the Transformation of American Politics in the 1970s. Meg, thank you.
Thank you so much.
The world's longest and deepest tunnel opened today in Europe. Switzerland's Gotthard Railway Tunnel is 35 miles long and a mile and a half deep. It runs under the Alps and links existing train lines between northern and southern Europe. Joining us from Geneva via Skype is AP reporter Jamie Keaton. And Jamie, there are already many tunnels crisscrossing the Alps. What makes this one so special?
Well, it's special because, first of all, it's long. It's longer than any other tunnel in the world, including a very important one in Japan. But it's also deep. It goes under a very jagged stretch of terrain through the Swiss Alps, and it gets from the German-speaking part of Switzerland down to the Italian-speaking part, and will really just open up the floodgates for quick travel, both for passengers and for cargo, from northern Europe down to southern Europe.
How long did it take for them to build this tunnel, and how much did it cost?
Well, this project has been a long time in coming. It's been conceived of for decades, but the actual groundbreaking and the first blasts, if you will, took place back in 1999, so 17 years ago. The total tab runs at about $12 billion, which is obviously a sizable amount of money. So this is quite a gargantuan project.
And where did they get that money? Because I'm just imagining if somebody were to propose a project like this in the United States, it would be very difficult to come up with the money for that.
Absolutely. There are a number of different ways that they've raised money for this. One is that they have obviously gone to taxpayers. They had a referenda here in Switzerland. They regularly have votes on major issues here. So the public speaks with much more frequency in terms of direct democracy. And they decided themselves to accept some of the tab. Part of the cost is also coming from fees on trucks that are going around. And then there are other sources of funding from Europe and elsewhere.
And what is the significance of this tunnel being in Switzerland, which, as we know, is not part of the European Union? Are they doing projects like this in the other European countries? Is Switzerland's rail network more advanced or less advanced than the other countries?
I wouldn't necessarily say it's more advanced, but certainly Switzerland is a country that relies heavily on rail. And just due to its geographical position, you know, Switzerland is surrounded by Italy, France, Germany, Austria, Liechtenstein. and so it's quite at the heart of Europe. So anytime that anyone wants to travel from north to south, Switzerland is right there. And so this is a useful sort of thoroughfare for all different types of travelers and companies that want to carry out commercial traffic.
How are the people in Switzerland feeling about this today? Is this a moment of excitement, or is it just one of the things that's going on in the world on Wednesday?
No doubt. This is a big deal for Switzerland. I mean, the country is really pulling out all the stops for this celebration. There was dancing. There was really a glitzy sort of ceremony with dancers dressed in orange miners' outfits with helmets and whatnot. It was quite a spectacle. So, yeah, Switzerland is really trying to showcase its technological prowess and at the same time show that it's a real player in Europe, even though it's not part of the European Union, that it still is a very integral part of the continent.
That's AP reporter Jamie Keaton in Geneva, Switzerland. In Switzerland, the country that has today opened up a new high-speed rail link under the Swiss Alps, longest rail tunnel in the world, 35 miles long. Jamie, thanks.
Thanks so much, Jeremy.
And just a few miles longer, by the way, than the tunnel, 31.5 miles long. And over the last year, we've been checking in from time to time with artists and musicians, asking the question, what is American music? Today, we'll hear from Aoife O'Donovan. She's an American folk singer and guitarist. She was raised just outside Boston, but spent her summers in Ireland absorbing the music there. She stopped in to speak with us while she promotes her latest album, In the Magic Hour, and we asked her to tell us her quintessential American playlist.
So we'll start with a song from a great record by Tim O'Brien, who's a multi-instrumentalist and vocalist, one of my all-time heroes. And this song is Tim O'Brien featuring Paul Brady, who's one of the great Irish folk singers, and they're doing an old traditional American folk song called Down in the Willow Garden.
Down in the willow garden, where me and my true love did meet. It was there we went a-courting. My love fell off to sleep.
I think that the concept of American music is interesting because America is a pretty young country. There's a lot of great traditional music that comes from America, but a lot of that music has its roots elsewhere as well. And I think this is a great example of real American music sort of coming, the music of Ireland and Scotland kind of coming over here to the Appalachian Mountains and then kind of becoming its own thing. The instruments you hear on this song, I heard a little bit of dobro, I heard some guitar, some double bass, and this sort of unmistakable style of singing that people associate with bluegrass and old-time music, sort of high tenor harmony, that to me, just these really open fifths, this just gorgeous, really raw-sounding vocal stylings that are unmistakably American folk traditions.
My father often told me that money would have set me free. But if I'd but murder that dear little girl whose name was Rose Connolly.
I remember the first time I heard this Lucinda Williams song. I was on tour with my band Crooked Still, and Greg List, the banjo player, played this track, and I thought it was sort of an unlikely Greg List DJ move. It's called Fruits of My Labor.
Baby, see how I've been wooing velvet curtains on the windows too. Keep the bright and unfulfilling light from shining through. Baby, I remember all the things we did. We slept together in the blue behind your eyelids, baby.
To me, this is the quintessential American song. It kind of illustrates the American dream and what can kind of go wrong in this one way. She's singing about getting out of Texas and kind of going west and trying her luck out west and sort of seeking fame and fortune and getting it. But then something is still missing. I think that's something that a lot of people go through as Americans.
Baby, sweet baby, if it's all the same, take the glory any day over the fame, baby. Sweet baby, I've been crying.
I just think that this is a great song for, you know, not just that, but also just how they're playing it and how they're sort of attacking it and how this sort of the slow groove and just the sort of repetitive nature of the changes, and her singing is just, it's unbelievable.
Baby, sweet baby.
If I had to go to a desert island and only bring 5 records, one of them would most definitely be Aeroplane by John Hartford. It's an unbelievable album. And the song that I chose from Aeroplane is the song titled Steam Powered Aeroplane.
Well, I dreamt, went away on a steam powered aeroplane. Went in the state and I damn near didn't come back again. I didn't go very fast on a steam powered aeroplane. Oh, the wheel went around and up and down and inside and then back again. Sitting in a 747 just watching them clouds roll by. Can't tell if it's sunshine or if it's rain, hey, hey. Rather be sitting in a deck chair high up over Kansas City on a genuine, old-fashioned, authentic steam-powered aeroplane.
Well, this is sort of a record that came out and was sort of, you know, hippie music back in the day. And it does sound, there's something so loose about it. Just the looseness of how they're playing the song, and it's almost silly, but it's so silly that it just kind of comes back around and becomes so beautiful and actually pretty deep, I think, again. Just something about the way he sings those lines and sort of like it's really so floaty and bizarre, but so deeply musical. It's fabulous.
Well, I like to be a pilot or a steam-powered aeroplane. Well, I pull that pilot wheel around and then back again. And I wear a blue hat, yeah, that says steam-powered aeroplane. Letters go around the rim and then back again.
Also, I feel like I really do picture an aeroplane when I'm listening to that. There's something about it that gives me a visual, conjures up an image of like a creaky old, you know, propeller plane, just sort of kind of teetering in the sky. I think that's maybe how they wanted it to feel. That the rhythm is just so, it's so on the edge, but it's there, it's flying. It's not, you know, it's, you think it's unsteady, but it's actually not. Here's a song from my latest album, In the Magic Hour.
The darkest night I ever seen, it was the night you came to me on your knees whispering, I'm sorry. Keeping time with your heartbeat, I danced along on 2 left feet. You kissed my cheek and left me on a city street.
I picked this song, it's called Porchlight, and the song, when I wrote the song, I was picturing a real American landscape, sort of sitting under a porch light. And I feel like a porch is a very American thing. I remember being in Ireland once and talking about sitting on a back porch and somebody kind of shouted from the crowd, we don't have porches here. So I feel like that's why I chose this song, Porchlight. Where else can you sit on a porch?
I want to sit under the porch light and watch the yellow moon rise.
As the world kind of changes and as we have more access to all different kinds of music, there are so many common threads throughout these things, and just sort of the thread of the music of the mountains and blues music and jazz music, and, you know, there's so much American music, there's all these kind of great traditions, but I think that the common thread is that sort of the human experience of being being a person. I don't know if that's distinctly American, but I think it's what draws people to listening to music in the first place, is that it's something that everybody can relate to when they hear words and melody and something that tugs at their heartstrings. It's sort of undeniable.
It's Irish-American folk singer Aoife O'Donovan with her quintessential American playlist. Her new album is called In the Magic Hour. You can find a link to it at our website, hereandnow.org, and check out all of our American music conversations with a variety of artists from all genres, like Michael Morgan of the Oakland Symphony, the rapper and producer known as Leaf, and singer-songwriter Roseanne Cash. They all answer the question, what does American music mean to you? And you can hear those conversations at hereandnow.org.
A couple of weeks ago, we had an intersection of emotions. First, for 86 days, our colleague Chris had been tracking his young son, Rowan, as he hiked the Appalachian Trail using a personal locator beacon that showed up on an online map here at work. Very exciting. And Chris went to visit Rowan when he reached New Jersey. A great day. But then we heard the news of Geraldine Largay. She was lost on the trail in 2013, and the official file of her disappearance was just released months after her body was discovered last year. The report included texts she'd sent her husband asking for help, texts that were never received because she was out of cell phone range. It was heartbreaking, and it also launched anew the debate about the benefit of technology in serious hiking. Axie Navis is senior gear editor at Outside Magazine. She joins us from Santa Fe, New Mexico. And Axie, overall, what do people in the hiking world think about technology?
I think the overarching opinion on those tools is that they are useful to have and to know how to use, but you certainly can't rely on them. Technology fails, electronics fail. You need to be able to know how to use a compass and a map if you're talking about navigation. And you need to be able to be self-reliant.
Well, in fact, as you well know, there are some people who are dead set against it. Tim Smith, registered master Maine guide, founder of the Jack Mountain Bushcraft School, tells Outside Magazine that one of the worst trends we've seen in the past 20 years is the proliferation of cell phones and technology. And the thinking is that it leads people to take risks because they think, what's the problem? I have a cell phone. So let's talk about some of these things and what they can do, but what they can't do. Start with the personal locator device. Now, I know that our colleague loves this, but how does it work?
Well, it basically works that it can be used in an emergency situation. It'll send out a message about where your location is. Some of them have two-way communication, so you can both send and receive messages. And one example that we look at, Spot, is a good example. It's called the Spot Gen 3 Tracker. And basically, you would have it on you, and you'd press a button if you want to send out your location. And then it would then use satellites to send a pre-programmed message to your contacts.
So Chris and his wife can turn on their computer. They find the map that relates to this, and they can see a marker that shows where their son is. But what's the drawback, though?
They don't always work in deep canyons, I've found personally. And then they also have a subscription service, so you need to know how to use it, and you'll also be thinking about paying anywhere between $15 to $100 for an annual subscription service so you can use the communication system.
Yeah, and that's one of the criticisms, that because it relies on satellites, you have to have clear sky, and sometimes people will hike up to a higher elevation to make that or other technology work, but that's the last thing you're supposed to do when you're lost. But what about just regular GPS that comes on cell phones?
You know, the GPS in your cell phone is actually pretty sophisticated, although we definitely don't recommend relying on your phone when you go out into the backcountry, one, because of lack of service, and your phone's just not built to handle the elements like that. If you're doing a short hike, sure, that GPS will get you will work just fine. But if you're trying to take on the Appalachian Trail, there are a lot of pitfalls. The battery life isn't great. You get out of cell service pretty quickly. Like you said, it then encourages people to hike in places where they maybe shouldn't be.
Yeah. And what about the cell phone for communication? This seems to be, from our reading, the biggest criticism from people whose job it is to find the increasing number of people who are getting lost is that they just think that it's like at home. I have it, so if I get in trouble, I'll have it. But you don't.
No, you don't. I think it can breed a sense of over-reliance on the phone and give us a little bit too much confidence. The good rule of thumb, I think, is to assume that the phone's not going to work as soon as you leave that parking lot. That's not always the case, but I think that's good to think about, and you certainly can't rely on it.
Well, we spoke with Warren Doyle of the Appalachian Trail Institute, quite a character. He's hiked the trail 17 times. He gives courses on how to do it. He tells people, you know, nothing takes the place of being focused, and that's one of the reasons that you hike, is to focus.
For sure. And that's something we see a lot with our readers. And that's one thing that we write a lot about. You want to get out and you want to have the digital detox. And it's not about having a lot of technology. I think that said, there are some tools that you can use. in emergency situations or in case you get into an emergency situation that might save your life. Can't rely on it, and it's good. You have to know how to use it, and you have to have backup plans, and you have to realize that there might be some failures. But as we see it, it's just another tool in your arsenal to pack.
Well, New Hampshire just took cell phones off its list of the 10 most essential things to bring on a hike, again, because of the concern that reception is so bad.
Right.
What are, you know, name the top three things that you have to have.
Definitely say a map and a compass, extra clothes, a lighter, some way to start a fire, some sort of emergency shelter. And you want to have those even if you're also thinking about bringing, say, a personal locator beacon or a handheld GPS device.
It sounds as if, Axie, if you set out to hike without knowing how to use a compass and a map, it's a fool's errand, you know, no matter how much technology you have.
It's kind of fail-safe. You know, if you know how to use it, you're going to be able to navigate in the backcountry. If you're going for a short day hike and you're going to be on set trails, you know, you probably don't need a lot of map and compass knowledge. But if you're attempting a big through hike and you're going to be out there for a long time by yourself, that is a really great way to be self-reliant. It's just not going to fail in terms of navigation.
Axie Navas, Senior Gear Editor for Outside Magazine, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
Well, I don't know. I'm going to brush up on my Girl Scout badge on compasses. But hikers, let us hear from you at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.